From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson is challenging conventional win-win assumptions about free trade. The low-wage, high-innovation economies of China and India, he says, demand a rethink. America may be losing big, and what then? Tonight on Point, the great Paul Samuelson on the new price of free trade. But first, we begin this hour with news of big changes at the country's second-largest financial institution, Fannie Mae. The trillion-dollar mortgage finance company today reached an agreement with federal regulators, giving the government more insight of its operations. Bob Haggerty has been following the story for the Wall Street Journal and joins us now from Westfield, New Jersey. Bob, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So there's Fannie Mae. It's enormous. Its money is behind millions of American mortgages. And what did it agree to do today?
Well, basically, it agreed to play by the rules of its regulator and change its accounting methods, hold more capital, and consider possible changes in its management to address the concerns of the regulator.
And what has the federal regulator been concerned with Fannie Mae? What's the problem here, Bob?
The main concern is the regulator feels that Fannie Mae's accounting has been designed to make earnings look more smooth than they really were, and in some cases perhaps even to help executives earn their bonuses.
So now they're going to be asked to keep more cash on hand relative to what they're lending?
That's right. And this fulfills something that the Bush administration and some people at the Fed have been asking for years. They've really been concerned about the very rapid growth at Fannie Mae, thinking that it could lead to some kind of a blow-up at some point and that the taxpayer would have to pay for a bailout. Now Fannie Mae has really sort of agreed to go into a straitjacket and follow orders from its regulator.
U.S. banks and banks around the world, especially in Asia, have lots of Fannie Mae debt, $940 billion in that debt. What's the scenario that overseers worry about with Fannie Mae, Bob Haggerty? If it went wrong, what might happen?
Well, I think at this point, people are certainly not seeing it as an Enron situation where the company is melting down. I think the concern is more that the company has a lot of interest rate risk, which it controls through use of hedging in the derivatives markets. And if something should go wrong with this, losses could pile up in a hurry, and there would be pressure on the government to prop up Fannie Mae. The Bush administration doesn't really want to have to do that.
Is it seen as teetering on that? Is this something that's been it's been close to?
I don't think so, although I think the latest concerns raised by the regulator certainly suggest that the company's capital cushion, which was never terribly large, is even smaller than we thought. A lot of this is still very unclear. It's going to depend on exactly how accounting rules are interpreted and exactly what happens to interest rates over the coming months. I don't think anybody's suggesting the company's teetering on the brink of disaster. I think it's more a matter of the company is being reined in as a precaution.
But clearly there's been a lot of very critical attention paid here. Is there a risk to the U.S. housing market if something goes wrong with this its biggest mortgage backer?
Well, if the company ran into huge problems and went under, that would probably have an effect. Nobody's really expecting the company to go under. The company may have to really reduce its growth or even shrink a bit. Some people think that that could have a tiny effect on mortgage rates for consumers on the order of maybe a tenth of a percent. Other people say any effect would be really imperceptible. Fannie Mae is a very big buyer of mortgages, but there are a lot of other investors who buy mortgages. So one player is not going to probably rock the market too much.
And today's measure, does it clean this up, or is there still a problem here? You said it's not an Enron situation, but even bringing up that comparison raises our antenna. You mentioned executives manipulating funds there to influence their own bonuses. Are we tiptoeing around a scandal, or is this braced up now?
Well, one thing we should remember is that these are accusations. They're not. It's not something that's been proven in court. The regulator has accused the company of manipulating its accounting and has ordered them to use different accounting methods. There is still a lot of uncertainty. The SEC is having an informal inquiry into this, and eventually we'll probably have to make some kind of ruling. The regulator, which is called OFAO, is also continuing its investigation. Congress will be looking at this. The company itself will be reconsidering the way it does things and its management structure. So there's a lot still to play for here.
And very big money. We'll be keeping an eye on that. Bob Hagerty, thanks for joining us tonight.
All right, thank you.
Bob Hagerty is a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Westfield, New Jersey. For decades, the orthodox view on free trade has been strong and simple. It can hurt, but it's worth it. Countries do what they do best, and everyone ends up a winner. But now, an economist who literally wrote the book on economics is asking for a second look at the win-win assumption. Nobel Prize winner Paul Samuelson says he's out to set the record straight to add nuance to the assurances of Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and Bush economic advisor Gregory Mankiw. And that nuance is not exactly reassuring. Getting cheaper clothes at Walmart doesn't make up for lost U.S. wages, says Samuelson. America could end up, he warns, a real loser in this trade. Tonight on Point, Paul Samuelson challenges the assumption of win-win in free trade. With the rise of China and India, is it still win-win? Up against cheap labor and high innovation, does the U.S. come out a net loser? And if the U.S. economy survived competition from Japan and Korea, why not from India and China? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson. He's professor emeritus at MIT, where he has taught for six decades. He's a former economic advisor to President John F. Kennedy and has consulted for the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve. His 1948 textbook, Economics and Introductory Analysis, is now in its 18th edition. He is one of the world's most influential economic thinkers. He's been writing about free trade in the Journal of Economic Perspectives. Paul Samuelson, welcome, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to be here.
Also joining us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beeny. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Professor Samuelson.
Hi.
So, Paul Samuelson, you're writing in a very dense economist's piece here in the Journal about free trade. And I have to admit, a good portion of this I cannot follow. You've got equations in here that are lines long. It's not my cup of tea. But I can read right in your abstract some phrasing that would turn anybody's head, talking about Chinese progress that might lower permanently measurable per capita U.S. real income. That doesn't sound like win-win. What are you reminding us of or warning us of here, Paul Samuelson?
Well, let me in a low-keyed way set the record straight. This isn't a case of little David, me, up against the Goliath of orthodox economic comparative advantage. That's the other way around. Nothing that I'm saying is new. Nothing that's happening in India and in China is new. It's exactly what's been happening since 1817, when the English economist David Ricardo developed the first theory of comparative advantage. It's exactly what was happening at the time when, middle of the century, 19th century. Why did I go public in this way now? Very simply, you have nice kids from affluent homes in the streets of Seattle deploring globalization, and there's anything that the mob of us union member economists agree on, you would think it's comparative advantage. And so lectures have been given to them. The trouble is the lecturers have forgotten what they learned in the seminars of MIT and Harvard and Stanford and Cambridge.
And many of them in your seminars at those places. And you're not talking about just anyone. You're talking about Alan Greenspan, Gregory Mankiw, the chief economic advisor.
I'll name names, mm-hmm. not because anybody is a villain or is an ignoramus, but repeatedly, Alan Greenspan, Dr. Alan Greenspan,
yes.
has testified before Congress about the unqualified benefits of free trade and freer trade. Name one. Name two. President Bush's chairman of his Council of Economic Advisors, on leave from Harvard, my neighbor, our former student at MIT, has written...
Gregory Mankiw.
Yeah, Gregory Mankiw. By the way, author of best-selling economics book.
Himself,
better
yes.
selling at this moment than some classic that you may have heard about.
Yes, yes.
Wrote a piece. I read them both carefully. Jagdish Bhagwati, distinguished university professor at Columbia.
Has been our guest here on a number of occasions. Strong for free trade.
Okay. And when I read their accounts, I saw something that was missing. Well, ordinarily, I don't go around correcting younger people than myself, but you reach a point when you think we'll just set the record straight.
Now, you summarized their thinking in your piece by saying, that, to paraphrase them, yes, good jobs may be lost here in the short run, but still, total U.S. net national product must, by the economic laws of comparative advantage, be raised in the long run.
Right.
To which you beg to
now,
there are
lots of win-win situations resulting from globalization, and I have not jumped ship against free trade. Mm-hmm. But I want us to be dealing off the top of the deck and give the qualifications. Free trade is not a win-win situation for everybody. It's not a win-win situation for every country, every region. It's not a win-win situation in the short run, and it's not, in every case, a win-win situation in the longest run. And what I pointed out is what is part of the orthodox theory of comparative advantage, to which I have been an important contributor. Mm. My colleagues and students have been important contributors. Mm-hmm. So I'm not speaking for Paul Samuelson. I'm speaking for the big guns in the field.
You're saying that they've left off the qualifications that are part and parcel.
Which is kind of understandable in an election year when what I call the nuances are not respected. One of my interrogators said, well, after all, Professor Samuelson, isn't a nuance? And I said, in the headlines, the devil's in the headlines, but often God's truth is only to be found in the nuances. So let's keep it straight. There are two kinds of inventions that can take place. They can take place, and I'm going to talk about inventions in China. I'm going to talk about new inventions in India.
Professor Samuelson, if you would, we're coming up on a break here, so why don't you hold that thought?
Okay.
But just to repeat the bottom line so that it comes across loud and clear, what you're describing here in this trade, the U.S. and China, U.S. and India, is, as you say, potentially lower permanently measurable per capita U.S. real income.
If inventions B type instead of inventions A type predominate now and in the future. There's nothing new about this because it's been happening between the South and the U.S. and New England for the 60 years I've been teaching.
We're going to come back and look at exactly where that threat might lie. We're talking tonight with Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson about his new challenge to the win-win conventional wisdom on free trade. Jack Beatty will come right back to you as well. Listeners, you can join this conversation with the rise of China and India. Does the win-win paradigm, as we've understood it popularly, still apply in free trade? Or up against cheap labor and high innovation, could the United States come out a loser? We're at 1-800-5800-TOM. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson, professor emeritus at MIT, about his new challenge to the win-win conventional wisdom on free trade. He says the United States may lose in its relationships with India and China. What do you think? With the rise of this kind of economic challenger, does the win-win paradigm still apply in free trade? And if it doesn't, what are the implications? What's the alternative? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Paul Samuelson is in a gentlemanly way naming names tonight. He says the way it's been simplified, the nuances sawn off by Alan Greenspan, Gregory Mankiw, Jagdish Bhagwati, and others, is missing some important points here, and we're going to hear the rest of that thesis. Jack Beattie, I want to get to you for just a second. We're hearing from a real staunch main pillar of the economic universe as we've known it. He's saying, "Watch out for the details, folks."
And it's a very, very important counsel, and it fits in with what seems to be a challenge to this paradigm of win-win. In a study you cite, Professor Samuelson, by Baumol and Gomery, they argue that in a world where you can make anything anywhere, everything may not work out for the best for everybody, and they pretty much come down with you that in some circumstances, trade beyond a certain point with a newly industrializing country can actually hurt industries in the advanced country, and quote, they even say have a quote adverse effect that is felt throughout the home country, making a country worse off than it would be if it isolated itself from trade altogether. That's a very autarky is a strange alternative, but
it's hard to imagine though that kind of isolation today.
Yes, but I want to make clear at the beginning that I do not favor protective tariffs. There's a guy named Dobbs that appears on television, asked me to come on his program. I refused.
Lou Dobbs, who's pretty upset about all that by now, the job losses.
Yeah, he's entitled. He's not an economist, yeah. But that doesn't stop him from talking about his opinions. I didn't want to get in with that crowd. You know, when you have a problem with the market economy, modern market economy, you want to be sure that what you do about the problem isn't like shooting yourself in your own leg and making it worse.
What do you mean there with regard to current circumstances?
Well, for example, suppose, I'll be specific, the word has reached Korea, where I write for newspapers, that America might be hurt by certain trends. And the editor there said, "Hey, in your next monthly column, tell us about Korea, because we're feeling the competition from lower wages in China. Right. If it can happen to America, can't it happen to Korea?" And I have done that, and I've written out specifically how it could come about. But we haven't got into how it comes about yet.
Maybe we should, before we get to the whole issue of protectionism or tariff responses, maybe if you could outline the sort of risk scenario that you're describing here.
Let me give you two different kinds of innovations, and let's have them be abroad in a country that has about 1/10 the wage level of the U.S.
Let's say China.
Yeah. And now I'm going to give you a win-win invention.
Okay.
Which I'll call invention type A. It takes place when something that we've been importing from Asia has a new invention. By the way, that new invention could have been copied from some American scientist or some research done here.
But it unfolds in China.
It unfolds in China. The result of that is that the kind of good that we import from them, have imported from them for a long time, is cheaper. That
not just because of their low wages, but also because of their innovation.
Because of their innovation. Actually, it'll slightly raise their wage. It'll still be low compared to ours, but, that helps them. Mm-hmm. I mean, that helps us, obviously. We can buy for less. Don't knock being able to buy from Walmart cheaper. You can get 20% less on your groceries,
hey,
this, that, and the other thing.
It's nice.
That's good. That's good. There is, as I've described it, no offsetting loss of jobs in the United States.
Okay. But there's another scenario that's not so pretty.
Yeah. Now, a lot of inventions in economic history have been of this win-win type. Mm-hmm. Every invention under competition from a world viewpoint raises world total income. But it's not part of the sound textbook knowledge of economics that it raises every ship's level. We know.
So what's good for the planet may actually be tough for the United States.
Yes, right.
In a given instance.
Right. And even on this A invention, what's good for the United States, it doesn't mean everybody in the United States has helped.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does mean, and I broke some new ground in showing how to measure these gains and losses, that there are more gainers in the U.S. in the A inventions than there are losers. And the gains of the gainers are so big that they could actually bribe the losers and everybody would be
come along, let's do this together, we'll share the party.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an extremely important part of economic history.
Yes.
It will be an extremely important part of the future. So don't go listening to Mr. Dobbs and panicking and think we're at the end of the world.
Do not ignore
new.
All of that
right.
net gain.
Okay.
But there's a net loss scenario you're
right.
describing as well.
But now let's take a different case. It happens to be outsourcing, but it doesn't have to be this new outsourcing. It's been taking place all along. I have a New York Bank credit card.
Okay.
If it's stolen or something, I would call up a local number, but I would be talking to Sioux City, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And a high IQ high school female graduate who was being paid about $3 over the minimum wage would handle my case.
Mm-hmm.
Today, when I do that, it's somebody in India. It's somebody in India who's learned about, been coached about the Red Sox, talks to me about
right.
about the Red Sox. Now,
mm-hmm. They've now, got an American-sounding yeah, nickname yeah, that they yeah. use, Danny, whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, Professor Bhagwati says, yes, but that's small. It's still small.
We have heard that it's not that many jobs in total that
that's
end
right.
up in that.
But that isn't the point. If it pays, what starts out small will become large. So I work out what the consequences would be of the gradual increase in the amount of that kind of service industry going there. Now, Isaac Newton, who's one of my heroes, great originator mm-hmm. of science, was asked, why do you think this Earth revolves in an oval around the sun?
Mm-hmm.
And why do you think Mars does? And he was very surprised at the question. He said, I calculated it. Well, I calculated this. And the cream of the jest is I calculated it with the $2.50 China made hand calculator. I worked out
right.
cases of what happens when India outsourcers get 2% of the market, what happens when they get 50% of the market, what happens when they get 75% of the market. I stopped short of when they got 100% of the market.
Thank you.
And what
a couple
do you think
jobs left here.
What do you think the answer is? The answer is not that we lose jobs permanently, because we, in a flexible system, we can get new jobs. But my calculated wage, which would clear the new market, is a lower real wage.
For the United States worker.
For the United States worker. But more than that, because my professional colleagues say, but have you counted any of the advantages to consumers? And I give the way of weighing the advantage to the consumer against the loss to the producer. And for these B-type inventions, it is a permanent loss. Now, let's be sure what we mean by permanent. Nothing that happens today is going to last forever. But if you isolate the effect of this thing for as long as it lasts, will there ever be light at the end of the tunnel? Will there ever be a little pot of gold?
Yeah.
And the answer is no for this.
Does that mean, forgive me for simplifying, but at some level, we need to, does it mean that the rise of China and India, with their capacity to do more and more of the second type of invention, innovation, as you describe it, inevitably or most likely means a lower real wage for American workers?
No. I'll tell you what it means most likely. That's an extreme.
Yes.
That is not an impossibility, what you stated.
Okay.
But that's an extreme. What it means is that if America was going to grow in real terms at 5% a year for the life of my 15 grandchildren, maybe it will grow at 3%.
That's a huge difference.
Yeah. Instead of having a wind at our backs, we have a headwind that is slowing down. Now, I think this happened to the UK. Victoria's the leading nation in the world.
1850.
Mm-hmm. Let's go from 1870 in America to 1914 in both countries. I don't think that we impoverished England, but I sure think that all these Yankee craftsmen who went over and observed what was going on there. They weren't allowed to write anything down, but they had memories.
They came back with a few machine outlines in their heads.
And just go to Watertown, Mass., where the first fall in the
Charles River is. Charles River and see all the old factories there.
That's the revolution. This is not new, and it's surprising there should be a firestorm. Because what do you think happened to Vermont farm wages when the Fertile West got settled? If you believe that wouldn't affect them, that everything is a win-win situation under competition, then I've got a bridge to sell you, and I want to tell you about the tooth fairy. So that's what this fuss is about. So let's be realistic. But there's a further point I want to make, and that is the American labor force is not one force. I made a calculation. I remember for a newspaper, back of an envelope in 1980.
Yes.
The 30% of our gain in real income per capita in the U.S. Mm-hmm. since World War II to 1980, we're talking, 25, 30 years, was due to globalization.
That's a pretty big chunk.
That's a pretty big chunk. Somebody wrote in and said, hey, what about black Americans and Hispanics? And making similar now I needed three envelopes to to back. I said, well, maybe actually they've been hurt just the way Hispanics who were in the U.S. at the beginning of that period were surely hurt by the leaky border from the South. Mm-hmm. Do you remember when President Fox was a friend of President Bush?
Vicente Fox saying,
it didn't last.
No, it didn't.
And he had a modest proposal.
Yes.
Just open the borders.
That's all.
And then you won't have illegal immigration.
Mm-hmm. That'll be legal.
Yeah. Now, the same things that would make that affect the lower income population's well-being by immigration takes place by the substitution of trade goods which come in.
Are you willing to pull all this over into political context for us? How should American citizens receive what you're saying?
Well, let me say this. In my judgment, I'm not an economic historian, but I think economic historians can quantify this. The globalization, which has been very important for the world standard of living, has increased inequality in the advanced countries of North America and Europe. Now, that goes
because lower-wage workers are more directly in competition with wage earners offshore.
Don't be impressed by the fact that I have a Nobel Prize, because Simon Kuznets, who got Nobel Prize a year after I did, he's now dead, was a great expert. And his theory was that before industrialization, incomes are very unequal.
Mm-hmm.
When you start to industrialize emerging markets, they get more unequal. But when we mature, they go back to being more equal. Well, the guy was two-thirds right.
They get more equal for a while, and then...
And actually, around the world, the Gini coefficients and all the technical...
Yep, the inequality measures.
Inequality is growing. So I take a lesson from that. I think that when an important part of the American population is not only going to have its growth rate in real income turned around in sign, that there
you
is...
Heading negative.
Yes. Now, I don't want to be political in a political year, but let me just say that if we did not throw away our tax base, we could
With
be
tax
using
cuts,
the tax base to do some rectification to slow down the harm that happens to particular people. Now, when I say that, I say to myself, yes, but if we help them, they'll be a little slower in scrounging around for a good, lousy job
right, and so forth. Right.
And then, as the New York Times reporter who wrote a very good account, which is rare in my experiences with the press, quoted, the last line was that if a thing is worth doing, it's worth incurring a little inefficiency for. And I think that the Scandinavian countries, which have not been freed of this, Sweden was probably third or fourth in the world in per capita income. It's now 17th. Part of it was they became too egalitarian, hurt incentives. But more important is Singapore, is Taiwan, is Japan.
Jack Beatty, no call here for tariffs or for trade protection, but a kind of important recalibration Paul Samuelson is sharing with us, saying you're likely to have a handwind from China and India that is real.
And that could bring down your standard of living.
Or slow down the rise in the standard of living would be, I think, a more realistic, less dramatic way of putting it.
Depending where you fall in the spectrum of incomes and wages.
Yeah, right.
But what's frightening is the usual answer is education, increase human capital. And yet the Bureau of Labor Statistics says that only 20% of all jobs by 2010 are going to require a college degree, and nearly half will require no more than on-the-job training. And the jobs they see are combined food preparation and serving workers, fast food, customer sales representatives, retail sales, on and on and on, all of them requiring face-to-face interaction and thus safe from foreign competition, but most of them really low wage. How do we deal with that, Professor?
Well, I think you have to be very careful here. The foremost expert on what the value of a college education has been, human capital, is probably Richard Freeman at Harvard University. And he does not detect yet a trend where we're going to have a proletariat of overeducated bachelors of arts. Being computer literate, being able to handle decisions still gives us a pretty good working force, and it can be better. But remember, a third to a half of the population is not always real energetic and gifted by DNA and environment.
Paul Samuelson, stand by. We're wrestling with some big issues tonight on free trade. It's upside, it's downside, with Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight, and happy to be so, with Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Samuelson about his challenge to win-win assumptions on free trade. He says, in fact, the U.S. may lose in its economic relationships with India and China. You can join the conversation tonight. If free trade is not necessarily win-win all the time, what's to be done? And if the U.S. economy survived competition from Japan, Taiwan, Korea, why not China, India? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with the great Paul Samuelson. Anita is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Anita. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I have a couple of quick points and a question.
Yeah.
I am probably one of those people who would have been in Seattle had I not had a job and three children to look after. And I'm not a fan of free trade. I don't shop at Walmart. And I believe in the philosophy of think globally, buy locally, and also believe in the philosophy of we can't keep on consuming at the rate that we are in this country and consuming the amount of resources of the planet's resources. Eventually it's going to catch up to us, and I think that's what I'm hearing tonight on the show, is that it is catching up to us, and we are in sort of a equalizing experience of
equalizing, perhaps compared to other nations. I don't know about relative to resources, but do you have a question as well, Anita?
Yeah, my question is, I heard a program earlier today, actually, about the World Trade Organization, and on NPR, and one of the speakers was saying that China is doing quite well in terms of trade, but that they have a fairly stringent protectionist policy, and I'd like to hear the speaker talk a little bit about that.
Anita, we'll pick it up with Paul Samuelson. Professor Samuelson, well, first of all, I'm curious what you make of Anita's perspective. She's saying this level of consumption can't go on, and she wants to think globally but buy locally. I just wonder about your intuitive response to that. And then what about China and the freedom of its own markets? How does that factor in?
Well, those are two quite
different.
Quite different things. It's true. There's one Earth, and there are limited and exhaustible resources. And it's a pity and a shame that my suburban neighbors and one of my multiple cars is an SUV that we should be using at this point of the game. The hybrid technology, hydrogen technology is pie in the sky, and to have the present administration tell us that they won't do anything about that except
until that comes along,
except give some money to that, is not the right way to handle it. On the other hand, it's not ethically right. Now I'm taking my Sunday sermon.
Okay.
That after we in the U.S. and Western Europe have enjoyed the longer lives and all the other worthwhile things that come with a higher standard of living, mm-hmm. that we want to pull up
the ladder there.
Mm-hmm. And not let China and the others. If we manage things right, there's always a race between scientists and the law of diminishing returns. And I'd bet my money on scientists if the voting populations in the democracies around the world were to take the sensible approaches to these problems.
Not be profligate, not be wasteful.
Right. And,
get behind, and
not have decisions made by the dollars of the lobbyists who can best provide the way that legislators get elected.
And to make clear the status quo, not the innovation that
quid pro quo for it, so that we're kind of in a General Grant, Warren Harding plutocracy where people haven't become more dishonest and so forth. They've just been told by their lawyers, by their accountants, be aggressive, reach out. Nobody's going to smack you very hard.
Get what you can grab. But what about this issue of China's own markets?
Let's take China is growing at 8 or 9%. It's
red hot.
Red hot. We want China not to be pegged to the dollar. We want it to have the Chinese yuan rise relative to the dollar.
Pegging its currency to the dollar is part of what's made all those blue jeans at Walmart so cheap.
Yeah. But China is not a free market for foreign exchange, so they don't have much of a problem because they're not depending upon market forces. So they, for the moment, have what some people consider the best of all possible worlds. They keep their currency cheap, so that keeps their exports. So my hand calculator was only $2.50 instead
right.
of instead of $5.
A kind of subsidy that's deliberate. Should the government of Washington be banging on Beijing's door about that, or should they say, no, we'll take the subsidy to those blue jeans at Walmart, and thank you very much?
Would you think banging, that they have the power to change? I don't think so.
I guess we're so indebted to China that maybe not. Maybe China needs that growth to keep up with its own population. Let's get another call here. Bob's calling from New York City. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. Thank you. It's an honor to speak to Professor Samuelson. I've read so much over the years, a BA in economics and an MBA, and I think he's hinted at the answer here, but he was mentioning Lou Dobbs and CNN, and I think one of the most spirited TV interviews I saw a couple of weeks ago was Lou Dobbs ripping apart one of the Republican congresswomen who was on, trying to defend that the market should dictate any kind of restrictions on outsourcing. And I'm curious for his thoughts on that because Dobbs was really
hammering, I bet,
blowing a gasket. But it was actually fascinating TV. And I'm just wondering. I'm a global banker myself, so I'm unfortunately responsible for some of the big companies when they outsource. I think one of the first deals I worked on many years ago was Smith Corona moving down to, I think, Mexico.
You're helping with the finance there.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm torn between being an economics major myself and just curious what Professor Samuelson's comments are on whether the government should legislate against outsourcing or whether it should be totally
I would be very much against that. And that's what I told the South Koreans, that the recipe to have an arteriosclerotic economy is to have a autarkical self-sufficiency by legislative fiat. If you want to be in South Korea like North Korea, God forbid, that's the bad road.
Legislate the economy and you'll go
there.
Bad road
to go. I've been in economics a long time. I've learned something. I've unlearned a lot of things. But I've not been able to find in the documentable historical record any case where a region involving millions of people can be run without important recourse to the market. But that doesn't mean that I've become a Milton Friedman and believe that laissez-faire. I believe that we need regulations, but I think we need rational, good regulations to correct irrational over-regulation. And it's a hoax that by giving affluent people like me millions of dollars in tax breaks, that you get more intelligent effort from them, which works for the rank and file of the American people. Is to blow up your stocks temporarily, dump them, and if you can, make your workers lock them in their pension fund with big holdings of those stocks. It's a reverse of incentives. So voodoo finance, you know, we could be on that. That would lead us to the demographic trouble.
That's another continent, and you're talking about Bush policy that you're not on board with. And I hear you speaking as though you're in the camp of economists who say, part of dealing with globalization is using the nation's wealth to buffer the impact of it on the portions of the society that get hit hardest by it.
By the way, you can't do that if you've given away the tax base.
So you're critical of Bush on that point. But what about on John Kerry? John Kerry says these jobs, this outsourcing isn't happening in a vacuum. He claims that American tax policy is actively encouraging it. He would, he says, turn it around, change that, and therefore sort of cut back the spigot of jobs flowing offshore.
Actually, there's a new study just today showing that for only tax reasons, there's been a big increase in reduction of the corporate tax rate. And so that's a no-brainer. You want to change tax subsidies to locate in the Cayman Islands.
So you're backing up Kerry on this initiative, this idea.
But I'm not here to make campaigns.
We're trying to get a fix on where you stand. Yeah. Devi is calling from Boston. Hi, Devi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm not an economist, and so I really don't understand most of what he's trying. I mean, I shouldn't say I don't understand. But my point is that, you know, for hundreds of years, these British and French and German companies have been coming to the third world, like what happened in India. I'm from India, so I can talk from an Indian perspective.
Okay.
These companies came to India, and the British especially, just robbed us blind. And now, after all these years, if we try to do it legally, and, you know, we came up through education, hard work.
Sure.
And now globalization is wrong because it is taking away jobs from the British, the Americans, and the French. And all of a sudden, everybody's jumping up and down about 200,000 jobs that have been outsourced to India.
You're saying fair is fair. Turnabout's fair play here.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these nobody ever, Lou Dobbs never brought a British company up in front of the audience of CNN and said, why did you steal all these resources from these third world countries? It's only, you know, when some small company outsources jobs to India, some 20 jobs to India, and he's all, you know, he's jumping up and down.
Then he's upset. Devi, we've got it. Our time is short, but let us pick it up. So, Paul Samuelson, here we are. You say that China and India will represent a headwind in your characterization of it, meaning U.S. incomes may grow more slowly, which is a loss in potential standard of living. Devi's saying, and I guess you alluded to it earlier, he's saying, look, we waited, we put in our time, we deserve a piece of the pie too, don't complain about it. Is that
I wasn't complaining
no,
about it.
No, I know, but he's speaking kind of in general, but do you agree with him, I guess?
Well yes, but I think I have something important to say, because I'm going to phrase the question this way.
Mm-hmm.
If I were an Indian on that peninsula in the 19th century or the 15th century or the present century, and somebody asked me, will you be better off if the rest of the world is as poor as you are, or will you be better off if the rest of the world is as rich as they have been? Probably as an economist, I would give a different answer to that than most lay people would do, and certainly most lay people in India. India got its freedom, became a democracy in 1947, I believe it was. For 30 or more years, it didn't do what it's now doing.
Didn't open up, didn't really play in the global market.
Yeah, I think its intellectuals went to the wrong universities.
but it is now, and you're saying fair enough.
I think that welfare is not like power. If Otto Bismarck gets more powerful than Louis Napoleon in France gets less powerful, it's a zero-sum game. That's not welfare. U.S. went from almost half of world GDP at the end of World War II, and we're now down to 20%. It's not because we got poor, we just grew slower. And I welcome that. And I welcome the fact that India now can begin to be more like China, be more the way Japan was. And it's a pity that the Mideast isn't like that, that Africa isn't like that. But that takes us out of economics and into geopolitics.
Well, we've just got half a minute left. On this issue of, are China and India different somehow than Japan and Korea? The U.S. went through that challenge, or seemed to. Are we up against something different now?
There's nothing. The potential, the Chinese all over the world, outside of China, have always been very entrepreneurial and successful. Why, within China, wouldn't you expect them to be the same thing? And once they got rid of Mao nonsense, because it was nonsense, the Cultural Revolution and the steel mills in every backyard, they've proved that they can do what we can do. You know, Americans' workers are not 7 feet tall, and European workers 3 feet tall, and Asian workers 2 feet tall. People are very much alike, and the places with good educational potential have been able to close the gap with the U.S. And I welcome that closing of the gap, because don't forget those good A inventions.
Those the ones that make us all better off. Well, it doesn't sound like any easy street here, but maybe a dose of realism. Paul Samuelson, thank you so much for being with us. And Jack, thanks so much for being on board.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.